You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 9th of January 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello from Studio One and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from London. I'm Tom Edwards, coming up on today's programme.
Do you understand what he did?
What did he do?
You tell me.
You tell me, what did he do?
No, you tell me. You tell me, why is he held captive?
They haven't released any charges. They haven't released any reasons.
Let me do this.
From a remarkable meltdown in North Korea to a debate on frontline reporting ethics, we'll review the day's top stories with Gavin McFadyen and Stuart Purvis here in the studio. Then we'll head to sunny Malta for a dose of the Baroque.
We are very, very Baroque without knowing we're Baroque. It's part of our nature. So, in fact, having a Baroque festival was rather a natural progression.
And as the new MoMA redesign is unveiled, we ask our man in New York City to see if the grand ambitions can be met. All that, plus a check-in with our man in the Eastern Med, and a bit of music, too, on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Plenty to look forward to, then, in the next hour of the programme. Before we get started, let's catch up with a World News Bulletin. Here's Jonathan Wheatley.
As fighting continues in South Sudan, peace talks in Ethiopia have resumed between representatives of South Sudan's President Salva Kiir and the former Vice President Riek Machar. The government has denied rebel claims that it'll use the peace talks and any agreed ceasefire to capture key areas taken by the rebels. Opposition spokesman Brigadier General Lul Ruai Koang claims they have won some key battles.
The government forces and other organized forces, I'm talking about the police, the wildlife and fire brigade, attacked our positions, and we were able to beat them back. And in the process, they suffered a lot of casualties, a lot of losses in terms of personnel and equipment losses. 200 government soldiers were killed, including very senior police officers.
The head of Syria's Building the State opposition party, Louay Hussein, has called for an independent delegation, not allied to the Syrian regime nor the opposition, to represent Syrians at the upcoming peace conference in Geneva on the 22nd of January. He said neither were looking after the interests of the Syrian people. Geneva too has been plagued by delays and sticking points, such as what role there might be for Iran, Assad's main backer. Here, the commanding officer of four American service personnel who were killed in a helicopter crash in England said they paid the ultimate sacrifice. They were killed when their helicopter came down near the Norfolk coast. Investigators are still trying to establish the cause of the accident. Colonel Carl Robinson is from the 48th Fighter Wing.
While UK civilian and military authorities were the first responders to arrive and secure the crash site, personnel from the 48th Fighter Wing Medical Group, Fire Department, Safety Office, and other emergency response agencies arrived shortly thereafter. We are continuing our coordination with the UK Police and Ministry of Defence as the investigation and recovery operations continue.
The Czech President Miloš Zeman will appoint Social Democrat leader Bohuslav Sobotka as Prime Minister within days, he said today, opening the way for a centre-left coalition to try to revive the economy after months of political stalemate in the Czech Republic. Zeman said he expected the full cabinet to be appointed by the end of the month. The Czech Republic has been without an elected government since Prime Minister Petr Nečas stepped down in June over a bribery scandal. Retired US basketball star Dennis Rodman has apologized for comments he made about an imprisoned US missionary in North Korea, blaming drink and stress. Rodman's fourth trip to North Korea has drawn criticism from human rights activists and the family of Kenneth Bay, after Rodman appeared to suggest that Bay, rather than the North Korean authorities, was responsible for his incarceration. US State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki was damning in her response.
In terms of Dennis Rodman's activities or comments, I'm not going to dignify them further with analysis or commentary on them. Our focus remains on reaching out through our own channels to North Korea about our desire to see Kenneth Bay released. As you know, we have grave concerns about his health, which his family also reiterated in their statement.
And finally, boxes filled with bananas and cocaine were delivered to five Berlin supermarkets in what police called a logistical error by drug smugglers. Supermarket staff discovered the containers with a total of 140 kilograms of cocaine shortly before the fruit went on sale to the public. Police and customs investigators have admitted. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan. You've not mislaid any luggage anywhere, have you?
I think Berlin has gone bananas.
Oh, dear. That's an immediate sacking offence.
Do you think so?
Quality puns, as always, from Jonathan Wheatley. More from him. Will he have more puns? We'll find out later in the programme. Right now, you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, and we'll be back just after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 6 minutes past 1800 hours, 1306 in New York City. Joining me now in Studio One with their take on some of the day's biggest news stories here in the studio are Gavin McFadden, director at the Centre for Investigative Journalism here in the city, and Stuart Purvis, professor of television journalism at City University London, and author of When Reporters Cross the Line, Heroes, Villains, the Hackers and the Spies. Welcome both to the program. Stuart, I sort of took this particular sort of delight in naming the title of your book because it's sort of germane to one of the first topics that we're going to talk about, which is the sort of the ethics, I guess, of frontline journalism. In particular, this story of a kid, basically, an 18-year-old stringer shooting photographs for Reuters, you know, whether he was a sort of a fully paid up member or someone who's just working from time to time. What do you make of a story like that? I mean, is this something we should be concerned about more widely? Because we so often see a real imperative on news organisations to reach out to the local community who perhaps don't have the training, they don't have the security. Is this a cause for real worry?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, when I wrote the book, When Reporters Cross the Line, what I discovered was no one knew where this line was. And if there were lines, there were lots of them. And I think what this case throws up is two different lines. One is, when is it appropriate to recruit somebody who is young or in some ways prone to some kind of, you know, threat to their lives? And the other one, which is different, which is, when is it appropriate to recruit to the media somebody who is actively involved in a struggle? And actually, both those lines apply here, which is why this case is so interesting and such a problem to Reuters. And therefore, in reading about it and to see the Reuters guideline, which is never cross the line, actually spelt out like that, and to say, but which line did you mean? It's become quite common now, in truth, for media organisations to say to people, look, we don't want to really commission you to do anything, but if you see something quite interesting, if you've got a good picture that we might be interested, let us know. What appears to have happened on this occasion is that they gave this young man, was he 17, was he 18 at the time? I guess we'll never really know. They helped get him the equipment. Now, to me, that is a kind of recruitment. And that's, I have always believed, and I, you know, as the, I used to be the editor of ITN, which is a big television news organisation in Britain. I used to say that the moment you actually commission somebody, they become one of your own. You're responsible for their security, their insurance. And sadly, some of those people died working for ITN for me. And we took full responsibility. There were other cases where people said, well, I never asked them to go, but I did tell them that if they were there, give us a ring. And therefore, I think news organisations just have to take these things even more seriously than they have done.
I mean, Gavin, you're sort of nodding your head there. Is that right? I mean, Stuart's right, isn't he? News organisations in these kind of combat zones, they can't operate in any kind of grey area. They need to take responsibility, do they?
I think that's absolutely right. I think there are a couple of background facts that should be brought carefully into the consideration. One of them is that this is the most dangerous period for journalists in history. I can't think of any other time when so many of our colleagues are being killed, shot at, with impunity. by our own troops in some cases. But, I mean, you're entering an extremely dangerous area. Unlike the wars that I covered in the 70s, in Central America, for example, you always knew where you should be and you shouldn't be. You went in with soldiers or you went in with guerrillas, but there was always a gun pointed in another direction, not at you. These days, you have no idea who's going to shoot you or under what circumstances. So the idea of employing a kid, completely inexperienced kid, to go into a highly risky, very dangerous position strikes me as is immoral and ludicrous. First of all, because he has no experience in protection. I'm not a great believer in going to military camps to protect yourself, but I certainly do believe that a bit of experience and most of the people that I was in wars with were in their 30s and 40s and knew what to do and knew how to cover themselves. That's not the case here. And then the final background point I would make is that it's quite common for Western news agencies now to hire a huge number of locals, not their own. The reason they don't hire their own is it because it's too dangerous. And then in that case, to hire a kid is even more ludicrous.
And I think the inevitable knock-on is that they end up hiring activists, stroke fighters, stroke terrorists, whatever you do. They, you know, they would not want to admit that, but that's almost inevitable. The more locals recruit, the less you can run any kind of checks on them. So this young man, I think a friend of his said he wanted to serve the revolution. Well, he saw himself serving the revolution by taking photographs, which could, in a sense, aid the propaganda campaign.
Right.
But, you know, I've seen films from Syria. There's a fantastic documentary called Across the Lines in which one person is at one moment a guy with a machine gun. Next minute, he's a photographer and he's kind of flicking between the two. So that is the reality. And I think news organizations just have to face that.
I mean, it's extraordinary sort of testament to the power, I guess, of the camera. People talk about the pen being mightier than the sword. The camera is so often mightier than the gun. I mean, Gavin, that's an interesting point, though, that Stuart makes about that impartiality. You mentioned your own experience, you know, a few years ago. It was rather more black and white. I mean, how do you safeguard against this idea of sort of people taking up the mantle and actually doing media, if you like, for a cause? I mean, is it possible to stop that happening? We talk about citizen journalists, the concept I'm always find rather troubling. How do you sort of safeguard against that? What's the way to approach that particular issue?
I think it's a complicated issue because so many of our own colleagues, experienced war reporters in many cases, are themselves partisan. They're there to do a job, and they do a propaganda job, often for their employers or for the government that they represent. And so to say that we are an objective core of impartial people is pretty ludicrous idea.
I don't think anyone would believe that
Indeed. So I wouldn't condemn this kid because he wants to do that. I would condemn the quality of his work if it reflected a totally biased position, shooting only one side and not the other and all the rest of it. I think that's, for me, not the most worrying part of it. It doesn't make me comfortable, but it's not the most worrying part. The most worrying part is his age and why he was there, because the news organizations that we all are part of are so cowardly that they won't send their own people into combat. That's the real reason they're employing kids. There should be lots of experienced hands out there doing it, but they're not. I mean, friends of mine have died out there because they've been on their own. Mm-hmm. And they, without the kind of support that we were used to in the Vietnam War and the Central American Wars and others.
We should obviously reflect. I mean, Reuters still suggests that he wasn't a proper employee. They gave him equipment and stuff as an additional safeguard, according to them. And they insist that he was just providing things in an ad hoc basis. Of course, I think it's fair to get that side of things across. Stuart, what do you think that the answer to this is as we move forward? So talk about the difficulty of covering these war zones. I mean, it's very treacherous for even experienced journalists. Often you do rely on people who are already on the ground. What do the next generation of journalists looking at this kind of thing, perhaps people are considering taking more training or, you know, the Tyro starting out, you know, should they rightly think, well, look, maybe this isn't a career. I don't want to be a reporter anymore. I can't put myself in harm's way. I mean, I don't think people will do that. But where does the responsibility lie? Is it with individuals, or do you think news organizations just need to front up on this?
Well, the problem is, and this goes back to some of the years Gavin was talking about. If you go back to the Vietnam War, there was almost a cult around young photographers who went to the front line, and movies were made about them, I can remember. And I remember at the end of the Iraq War, the last Iraq War, a young man who'd worked in the ITN newsroom, just kind of monitoring video and things, went out to Iraq on his own, at his own, initiative. And within a week, he was shot dead in the street. And it kind of reminded me that however romantic we might think the life of a war correspondent is, it's no proper job unless you've really, really, you know, learnt your skills. So yes, there is training. But I think the two rules I would put, you know, lines, if you like, I would suggest is one is, you say, is to say that the moment the news organisation actively helps somebody to do something for them, they own them and they should take responsibility. And the second thing is to be more honest about who is taking these photographs, to be more transparent, to say, yes, this young man was, for instance, a member of a rebel brigade and we made that clear when we issued his photographs or something like that. But to be ducking and diving about, well, we didn't may or may not know whether he was a member of the rebel brigade. I think you just have to, I say, you have to be honest about these things.
Yeah, and Kevin, would you go along with that? There's totally, no other, there's no sort of, you know, easy solution is there for this kind of thing?
Well, except that you don't do it. I think you don't employ kids into combat zones. You don't employ people who are known combatants into combat zones to represent a neutral network. I mean, I agree totally with Stuart about that. It's entirely wrong.
Intriguing stuff. Let's move on and talk about a story in its own macabre in its own way, far less serious, I guess. Though one could argue, in fact, there's similarly sort of life and death issues at stake. North Korea. We've seen these extraordinary scenes over the past few weeks continuing. The most high-profile American visitor to the country, of course, well, probably most people would say Dennis Rodman. He's back on another visit to the Hermit Kingdom. He embarrassed himself, infuriated people, upset a great deal of others. Let's take a very quick listen to one of his more recent meltdowns.
Do you understand what Kid and Bay did?
Yeah.
Do you understand what he did?
What did he do? You
in
tell
this
me.
Country.
You tell me. What did he do?
And no. You tell me. You tell me. Why is he held captive?
They haven't released any country? Charges. They haven't released. They haven't released any reason.
Let me do this. I would love to speak on this.
Go ahead.
You know, you got 10 guys here. 10 guys here. They have left their families, left their damn families to help this country as a sports venture. Got 10 guys, all these guys here. Do anyone understand that?
We do, and we appreciate that, and we wish them well with cultural exchange.
No, I'm just saying, no, I don't give a shit. I'm your rash ass what the hell you think. I'm saying to you, look at these guys here. Look at them.
Yeah, but Dennis, don't put it on them. Don't use them as an excuse for the behavior that you're putting on yourself.
They came here.
You just basically were saying that Kenneth Bay did something wrong. We don't even know what the charges are. Don't use these guys as a shield for you, Dennis.
The extraordinary Dennis Rodman. He has obviously come out and said he was under a great deal of pressure. He'd maybe had some liquid refreshments to help him tackle the stresses he was under. But if we look at this problem, I mean, is there a sort of clear exploitation here? I mean, is Dennis Rodman a well-meaning but misguided celebrity? Is this more sinister? How has he managed to get himself involved in this? I mean, do you think there's culpability here from people within North Korea who've just decided he's an easy pawn to manipulate? Or does he just need to take some personal responsibility?
I think it's neither. I think it's the networks. I think it's the broadcasters and the news media that gave him a platform and that gave him all this publicity. I mean, in every war I've ever been in, there's been a sea of lunatics, crazy people, drug addicts, alcoholics saying the most astonishing things, but we don't give them a huge platform to embarrass themselves or anybody else. It's not as though this was a legitimate political position that needed an exposition. This guy is a crazy man. And I think to give him that platform was a cheap sensationalist trick. Quite common, actually, in that kind of broadcasting. So I didn't find it outrageous. I found it sad.
Stuart, what do you make of that?
Dennis Rodman was a fantastic basketball player. Let's just acknowledge that, because there's not much else we can acknowledge about Dennis Rodman. Somewhere after he stopped playing, he kind of seriously lost the plot and became a kind of mouth for hire. He appeared on kind of celebrity shows where he was locked up in rooms with people who, goodness knows, the pressure, you know, the stress they went under, let alone the stress that he went under.
But what about that point Gavin makes about the role of the networks then? I mean, it's hard to not give a voice when it is so kind of morbidly entertaining.
Well, it is immoral.
But there's some terribly serious issues
here.
The interesting thing was he went through
a sort of transvestite period when he dressed up as a bride and thing. I thought he was really quite restrained the other day when he sort of sang Kim Jong-un's happy birthday to him. But the problem with him is that actually just occasionally people like this actually have an impact for good as opposed for hilarity. So if you look at, I mean, Kenneth Bay was charged with, I think, planning to overthrow the North Korean government. I suspect most people think he wasn't. He was a guy who had kind of mission to try to, you know, humanitarian almost. So he's in jail for 15 years. The State Department, I'm sure, would love to get him out. They don't really have their own relations with North Korea. Does anyone have proper relations with North Korea? I suspect at the back of their mind, they just look, Rodman's a nuisance, but actually, you never know, he might actually come up with something. So they want to distance themselves from him. But you're absolutely right, Gavin. In that clip there, I think it's a CNN reporter who is having a lot of fun, yeah, isn't he? It's absolutely winding Rodman up. And as you say, Rodman actually said later, I had been drinking, much to our surprise. So it's sad that he, you know, a great sportsman has got to nap himself in his position. And he's definitely been exploited by a number of people from the North Korean government to the networks. But we couldn't rule out that one day Kenneth Bay might walk out free and say, thank you, Dennis Rodman.
Well, I was going to say, would you eat a slice of humble pie, Gavin, if it turned out that actually Dennis Rodman was the great facilitator?
Totally. But I think on the other hand, we could go to any insane asylum and pull anybody out and hope to bet for the best.
We're going to take, on that note, surely, a very short break. You're with Midori House, with me, Tom Edwards. Gavin and Stuart will still be here up next when, amongst other things, we'll discuss the new look of the online New York Times and more besides.
In Istanbul, they took to the streets in a battle for green space. In Sao Paulo, they marched in their thousands in a fight for cheaper buses. In Athens, they shouted loud to demand a better-run capital. That's why urbanism matters, why words like density, infrastructure, and smart cities need to be dragged out of city hall conclaves and turned into a public debate. And that's why every week, Monocle's show, The Urbanist, reports from cities around the world that are getting horribly wrong and deliciously right, visits the mavericks and mayors with a vision further than the edge of their desk, and asks the questions that will shape how we live tomorrow.
Who governs the city, who owns the city, who has a right to decide what happens in the city?
The bridge becomes an instrument not of moving traffic, but of land development.
There needs to be a voice for the people that says, okay, now we need a library, now we need the green park. These things that are greater than the individual interests.
Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24, ticking towards 1823 here in London. Still with me, Tom Edwards, is Gavin McFadyen, director at the Centre for Investigative Journalism in London, and Stuart Purvis, author of When Reporters Cross the Line. Let's talk a little bit more about reporting. Let's talk about newspapers or their online outlets, at least. The New York Times has unveiled a new look to its website to a great deal of fanfare, some criticism, some positive remarks. Gavin, if I can start with you, it's interesting, isn't it? We talk quite often here at Monocle about newspaper redesigns and how often actually it seems nobody really wants them, and the one thing you must never change is the crossword and this sort of thing. When it comes to news on the web, is it a different dynamic? Do you think that it's important to keep making changes? Do you think that actually, with the sort of sheer volume of web media at people's disposal, are the readers actually that fussed?
I don't think they are. I think that it's an age group phenomena, and that young people will watch the box more than the fact that the elderly and all of us. I think there's no doubt that it's attractive to them. I mean, if you look at one of the most popular sites in the world, which is the Mail site, which is filled with naked women and all the rest of it, it's very attractive if that's what you want to see. Nobody would read it for the news. I think what's interesting about the New York Times development is that apparently the news isn't that important either. It would appear that all sorts of extraneous stuff is very important in their hope that they can appeal to people, I think, on this rather strange commercial basis. I'm not sure I fully understand what the thinking behind it is, but the idea that infomercials or something equivalent to that has a role in the press of the gravity of the gray lady is an astonishing notion, I think.
Stuart, what do you make of their tweaks? I mean, is it tweaks? Is it something more substantial? How sort of sensitive are you when these things change?
Well, like Gavin, I don't like wake up like worrying about how they're going to lay out the pages. But I mean, you know, from what I understand, there are a couple of changes here which actually are not other people have done them first. Mm. One is that certainly we grew up with the idea of pages. So on the New York Times, you used to have page one and you click for page two. Here, you click on the story and it just runs continuously. Mm-hmm. That makes kind of sense. What I remember about the kind of start of this era was I do remember when I was starting a site at ITN, a consultant saying, you must have as many pages as possible because each page view is important because each page view equals money. And he said, you know, for every page view, you will make a certain amount of money. And I said, what? Whatever we put on the page will make money. He said, yeah. I said, that's an unusual idea. And of course, that was the whole part of the bubble, you know, just pages for sake of it. Now, apparently, page views don't matter in that sense. It's the kind of continuous read. And I gather that's all to help you see more ads further down the page. So there is Gavin said, a commercial idea behind it. And lots of use of arrows to help you go from one place to another. That seems to make sense to me.
Well, I think.
The other thing is, I'm always fascinated by the New York Times' obsession with dining. I mean, I come a bit of a foodie myself, so I don't have a problem with this. But it is interesting how prominent the dining sections are getting in the New York Times, and I guess that just reflects the times, right?
Absolutely. But just in terms of the idea of sort of relaunching and rebranding, it is rather a delicate enterprise. I wonder, it's a bit of a different world in sort of TV news, but people are very sensitive, aren't they? They tend to be very defensive often, your viewing or reading or listening public to changes. Is that something that you were always very conscious of when you had your editor's hat on?
My back is full of scars about relaunches and revamps, Tom, really. So much work goes into them internally. And I can remember doing one for the flagship news on ITV, which featured an aerial of the ITN headquarters building. And I was so excited about this. I hired this sort of forerunner to the drone, really, which would hover above the building. We would turn the lights on, so the lights of the building lit up. And it was, you know, and the music was playing. It was fantastic. The viewers hated it. I mean, so, you know, who cares about your building? You know, we just want the news. So, no, and the other thing, I think what's happened in British television is the breakfast shows on ITV, as we call it here, have been constantly revamped and revamped, and the viewers have just gone away. They say, look, I can't cope with all this revamping. I used to quite like it the way it was. So, I mean, for everyone who revamps for no good reason, beware, I say.
Absolutely. Gavin, so more likely to be sort of clicking onto the New York Times from now on? Or
no, I think less
largely
now.
Actively less. Well, that's at least one they can count without. There we are. They won't be pleased to hear that, but never mind. Let's talk about another sort of media story. Let's go back onto the small screen. Here in the UK, Channel 4 is continuing to broadcast a series on benefits claimants. It's called Benefits Street. It's been fairly controversial for various reasons. And there's a lot of talk, generally speaking, about the issue of covering benefits, these kind of social issues, immigration throughout the EU, but particularly here in the UK. Stuart, I know you have sort of personal connections into this issue, but what do you make of this? A lot of people are very unhappy and they say this is rather unpleasant. It's sort of exploitative. It panders to a nasty populist streak without obviously sort of drawing into criticism of the actual programming side.
Yeah,
of this.
I mean, as you said, I should declare that, as you say, I'm a director of Channel 4 overall. I'm on the board of Channel 4. That doesn't mean that I schedule the programmes or make the programmes or anything like that. So we always prefer to leave that to the management. The management has explained that this is basically a documentary series taking one street in Birmingham where a large proportion of people are living on benefits. They say that the point of one of the main points of the programme is to show the community spirit which exists between these people. There are other elements of the programme which have been picked up by the newspapers, and obviously they're free to comment as viewers. But what you can't get away from the fact is that this benefits issue is a big one. Sometimes it's combined with the immigration issue. And the issue then is, are immigrants coming to the country and claiming benefits? And clearly, politicians believe that there are votes in that. I think the evidence that it's quite the way as bad as it's suggested, that may not be the case. But certainly it's a hot topic in Britain, and it's a particularly hot topic in Britain because of the existence of this party, UKIP, which is strongly against immigration from the European Union. And certainly I think they see some connection between immigrants and benefits.
Gavin, yes, the rights and wrongs of that particular argument, I sense, will run and run, certainly here in this country. Do you ever feel a sense of unease, though, about the way that certain media tackle this subject? Is there a pandering to these sort of nasty populist streaks at times?
I think I agree with you. I think that's exactly what's involved here. It's an attempt to do something they couldn't do in other areas. In other words, you could not make for British television a program slagging off Romanians, Bulgarians, Greeks, other swarthy peoples who solely come here only to use the National Health Service and to steal from the pockets of poor old ladies in Leeds. I think this program represents some of that, not all of it, and they tend to cover up some of their own bias in that sense by talking about community values. But in point of fact, what it does is it strengthens the hand of the far right by legitimizing their claims in many ways, and the Tory right, for that matter, as well. And I don't think it's uniquely British. I think it goes across the current in the United States, in Germany, in France, in Spain in particular. Greece, there are programs that are openly fascist that take the same line. So it's a curious business. I mean, it's a legitimate area, but the balance to me was missing. I could find streets somewhere in other cities which would be exactly the opposite. Mm. But that's never given the prominence I think that it actually deserves.
And Stuart, just briefly on this, I wonder sometimes, you know, there's powerful words from Gavin. Do you think sometimes we, you know, overestimate the importance of this and talk this up too much? I mean, program makers will try and, you know, grab people, they'll try and get their attention, they'll try and be a little controversial, they'll say this delivered successful ratings. Is actually that often what's at play here? Are we wrong to consider these things as sort of, you know, sinister, pandering to those kind of elements that Gavin described? Should we all just maybe take a step back and say it's only some programming, you know, it's not the end of the world?
Well, all I would say is that there are what's known in the jargon as ob-docs, observational documentaries. So Channel 4 made one about a school in Yorkshire which had a high immigrant number of pupils. This had what most people thought was one of the most fantastic TV moments of the year, when a young student who had a terrible stutter, his teacher helped him to get over the stutter, he made an address to the class. That is classic observational documentary. You're just saying, look, we are showing you what's going on here. So I think the programme makers, if they were here, would say this is a classic observation documentary. Clearly, Gavin and others are perfectly entitled to their opinion about are there other agendas that operate, but that's what I think it's set out to be.
Wonderful stuff. Gavin McFadden and Stuart Purvis, thank you both very much indeed for joining us here at Midori House today. Plenty still to come in the second half of today's programme, so stay tuned to Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monaco 24.
Oi, London. This is Monaco 24.
Op London, tu vai Monaco 24.
Fra London, dette Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monaco 24.
You're listening to Midori House at 1833 in London. We'll be checking in with our man in Istanbul, getting a taste of the Baroque in Malta, and reviewing the redesigned MoMA building in New York in the second half of the programme. Before that, though, let's hear from Jonathan Wheatley, who has the latest world news headlines.
Thank you very much. As fighting continues in South Sudan, peace talks in Ethiopia have resumed between representatives of South Sudan's President Salva Kiir and the former Vice President Riek Machar. The government has denied rebel claims that it'll use the peace talks and any agreed ceasefire to capture key areas taken by the rebels. The head of Syria's Building the State opposition party, Louay Hussein, has called for an independent delegation not allied to the Syrian regime or the opposition to represent Syrians at the upcoming peace conference in Geneva on the 22nd of January. He said neither were looking after the interests of the Syrian people. Here, the commanding officer of four American service personnel who were killed in a helicopter crash in England said they paid the ultimate sacrifice. They were killed when their helicopter came down near the Norfolk coast. And the Czech president, Miloš Zeman, will appoint Social Democrat leader Bohuslav Sobotka as prime minister within days, he said today, opening the way for a centre-left coalition to try to revive the economy after months of political stalemate. Zeman said he expected the full cabinet to be appointed by the end of the month. And that's latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan. More news from Jonathan, of course, at the top of the hour. You're with Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's 21:34 in Moscow, 18:34 here in London, where it is time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the globe. Today we're off to Istanbul. Our Eastern Mediterranean correspondent, Joseph Dana, joins me on the line. Joseph, good afternoon to you. Thanks for being on the programme. I know you have a number of stories from all across the region. I almost don't know where to start. How about Israel? What have you got for us?
Well, really, one of the major stories in the Eastern Mediterranean this week is the major protests that have been happening with African refugees, African migrants in Israel. Basically, there's about 60,000 of these refugees that have been protesting for basic recognition of their asylum claims. And in today's Haaretz, the liberal Israeli daily, there's a very interesting piece that came out about the Israeli arms industry, and there is a connection between these two stories. Effectively, there was a Freedom of Information Act request by an Israeli lawyer to find out exactly where Israel is sending its many arms shipments around the world. Everyone that knows Israel knows that this is a country that has a massive arms industry, and it's really one of the fundamentals of the GDP in the country. But no one knows exactly who Israel is sending these weapons to. And there are some very interesting revelations. Israel's apparently selling weapons to the United Arab Emirates, Pakistan, Algeria, and there's rumors that they're actually selling weapons to Eritrea, which would be an incredible event considering very few Western governments have any open relationship with the dictatorship in Eritrea. And the African refugees that are on the streets of Tel Aviv and Jerusalem this week are many of them are coming from Eritrea themselves. And so there's probably a very interesting connection going on between the African refugees in Israel, the Israeli government, and Eritrea.
It's certainly an intriguing link, Joseph. I just wonder, what do you think that the reaction will be to that, you know, within Israel? Will people be concerned, or do you think that there was a sort of a tacit sort of acknowledgement that those kinds of deals were perhaps in place anyway?
You know, it's very interesting because both things happen at the same time. There was an incredible editorial by the editor of Haaretz basically demanding that the government kind of come clean with the arms deals that it's engaged in around the world, saying that the Israeli people have a right to know if the Israeli government is selling weapons to Azerbaijan or to Algeria or to Turkmenistan. But at the same time, there is a certain tacit acknowledgement that this is kind of how the country works. Everybody knows that there's a very deep arms industry in the country, and so arms industries usually deal with very shady players, as it were.
Absolutely. Let's move on, Joseph, and talk Turkey. We're sort of used to seeing some various kind of scandals documented, but there's a couple of interesting sort of asides, aren't there, in some of the latest concerns.
Yeah, there's a very interesting aside in terms of Turkey's regional position in making itself into an energy exporter, an energy conduit. As we know, the Turkish government, the current Turkish government, wants to see Turkey's position, its geographical position, used to the benefit of the Turkish government by exporting and becoming a conduit of natural gas and oil and whatnot. Now, the first major step towards this dream for the Turkish government is an unlikely partnership with the Iraqi Kurds, the Kurds in northern Iraq, and there's now a pipeline, an oil pipeline, that is going through Turkey to the Mediterranean coast carrying Iraqi Kurdish oil. Now, what's interesting about this story in terms of the corruption scandal is that no one knows exactly where this pipeline is, and no one knows if this is a new pipeline, and if it is a new pipeline, who actually built the pipeline. One of the major reasons why this has happened is because any sort of agreement between the Iraqi Kurds and the Turkish government would necessarily bring in the Iraqi national government, basically bringing in Baghdad. And Baghdad sees Iraqi Kurdish oil as its own, as a national kind of resource. And so it doesn't want to see the Kurds in the northern part of the country basically enrich themselves and move towards autonomy. And so it seems as though there's some very shady kind of backroom dealings going on in terms of getting this oil out of the ground in northern Iraq, across Turkey, and onto the Mediterranean.
Joseph, you always have tales of shady dealings for us, be they arms or oil or pipelines. Have you got anything a little, I don't know, a little light, a little brighter to maybe lighten the mood somewhat?
Well, I wish I could say it's a very bright story, but it is a kind of curious story. So a couple of years ago, there was an Israeli cell phone company called Cellcom that ran a somewhat controversial commercial in Israel. Basically, a number of Palestinian kids were playing football on one side of the Israeli separation barrier in the West Bank, and they accidentally kicked the ball over the wall. It landed next to a group of Israeli soldiers who kind of looked at it, you know, funnily, and then kicked it back, and there was a bit of a volley going on between these two parties. And this was a bit controversial, but it was also a very kind of cute commercial. Now, what's funny about this story is that this week, a number of Palestinian kids were playing football next to an area in the West Bank that the Israeli army had confiscated to build the separation wall, and they inadvertently kicked the football into this area, and the Israeli soldiers in this case would not return it. And so these kids in this very, very small village have now written an open letter to the United Nations demanding that the Israelis give them back their football, as it were.
What likelihood of success in your humble opinion, Joseph, then, for them to get their ball back?
Well, hopefully, if they watch this commercial, which I encourage everyone to check out on the internet, if they watch the commercial, maybe they'll be taken by the spirit of the global game, and they will, in fact, return this football. But it's anyone's guess.
Absolutely. Well, let's drink to that one anyway. Joseph Dana, Monocle's man in the Eastern Mediterranean. Thanks, as always, for joining us here on the programme. Up next, we're off to Malta. Stay tuned to find out more on this episode of Midori House on Monocle 24.
In 2014, the Foreign Desk is coming to Monocle 24. Interviews with presidents and prime ministers, reports from the front line, the debates, the arguments, the analysis on the world's most important stories.
There are two conventional wisdoms in Europe at the moment. The first is that the far right will dominate and be very successful at the European elections, and the second is that the far right is on the rise across Europe generally. We need to correct those two assumptions.
My hope would be that the new government in China feels sufficiently secure next year that they can ease up a little bit on the rather worrisome repressive tendencies.
Every Saturday at 12 noon in London, and available for download all week on monocle.com, iTunes and SoundCloud.
This is a challenge, to give them the knowledge, to give them the hope for the future that they can reintegrate into society, believe that they can get a job, get them to decouple from criminal activities, and we have more to do when it comes to these matters.
I'm Steve Bloomfield. This is The Foreign Desk. Join us from Saturday, the 11th of January.
Are you tired of overcooked and overrated culinary trends that never quite hit the spot? Fed up of being spoon-fed half-baked ideas on the next big thing? Then tune into The Menu with me, Marcus Hippi. Every week we introduce you to the world's top makers and shakers, cocktail creators and the best bread makers as we uncover gourmet street food, big-time baristas and wily wineries.
Once upon a time it was seen with disdain, but over the years that culture had gotten so popular it's iconic now.
If you're serving decent food in East London, I don't think you've got any problem getting custom in. And I worked in the West End for years, you know, I mean, it's not always packed in the West End, trust me.
This is the show that discovers how coffee can change a country and how chocolate can make us live longer, all in the search for exciting local food producers and the most original entrepreneurs.
That's The Menu, every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Time for a bit of Baroque now on the programme. We're heading to Malta, to Valletta to be precise. Many of you may be familiar with the city's Baroque architecture, but what of its heritage in Baroque music? If you haven't heard about this yet, you surely soon will, thanks to the International Baroque Festival, the second edition of which gets underway there tomorrow. I spoke with Kenneth Zamit-Tabona, Artistic Director of the Manuel Theatre and Valletta International Festival, to find out a little more. What is it about Valletta that makes it the perfect place for a Baroque music festival?
The city, unlike many other cities in Europe, was actually conceived in the 16th century. Valletta was sort of the foundation stone of Valletta was laid in 1566, just after the Great Siege of Malta in 1565, by Grand Master de Lavalette, who actually gave his name to the city. and that became Malta's capital. So, in fact, there is nothing in Valletta which predates 1566. So this is why Valletta, which is very small, is so appropriate to have a Baroque festival, because Valletta as such is full of Baroque monuments.
Absolutely. It's exciting times indeed. Is there a sense perhaps that people are maybe familiar with the architecture and the art of the Baroque period in Malta, but maybe not so much the music? Is it a bit of a missing piece, if you like, to that puzzle, do you think?
The music, you mean?
Yes.
Yes, in fact, that's the strange thing. The Baroque music is on the wane everywhere in Europe. Playing Baroque music, especially in the Baroque idiom with Baroque instruments and at Baroque pitch, is, you know, the dernier cri. It is extremely fashionable, and quite rightly so, because there's an enormous amount of music which remains, you know, to be discovered, literally. Now, we've had all the components. Malta is still remains a rather Baroque nation anyway. This is what I call it. Even our festas, which sort of happen, you know, there are about a dozen at a time every Sunday in summer, with the fireworks and the bands and the statues and the angels and all the banners. And so, therefore, you know, we are very, very Baroque without knowing we're Baroque. It's part of our nature. So, in fact, having a Baroque festival was rather a natural progression.
Absolutely. I like the idea of being Baroque but not really knowing it. Kenneth, tell us what exactly people will find then as part of the festival. Clearly, a lot of the events take place inside a number of the famous churches and palaces you describe, and which will perhaps be familiar to obviously local people and other travellers who are familiar with Valletta. What's the sort of the ambience, do you think? Is it a kind of a family-friendly thing? Is it about refamiliarising people, educating them to the qualities of the Baroque music? What's the sort of the ambience like?
Start with the quality. The quality is definitely there. I mean, our big concert this year is the English concert conducted by Harry Bickett in St. John's Co-Cathedral, which is the grandiose cathedral which was built by the Knights of Malta, on Monday the 13th in the evening. So that is a very important, it's the crowning concert of the whole festival. And that takes place next Monday. Then, of course, we have smaller concerts in the Manuel Theatre, which is a 1731 theatre, which is our national theatre, as it so happens to be. So we have a lot of concerts, like a lot of Rameau this year because of the anniversary. We've got four Rameau concerts. We're starting off with a parody of Rameau's Hippolyte Tarissi by Charles Simon Favart, a sort of 1066 and all that. I mean, with an English-speaking audience, I'm sure a lot of people would be familiar with the great spoof, which was written by Sellers and Yeatsman, I think, in the 40s, about English history, called 1066 and all that. This was done long before, in the 18th century, contemporaneously with Rameau's opera, which incidentally he wrote when he was 50 years old, his first opera he wrote when he was 50, and then there was no stopping him. And it was so successful that Charles Simon Favart wrote this parody. So there's that as well. We've got the Monteverdi Vespers, we've got Handel's Messiah, and I'm talking about big guns, you know, so these are sort of what we call in Italian the cavalli di battaglia, the war horses of Baroque music. So already in the festival we've got three enormous, what I've called colossal and very popular religious works: the B minor Mass, the Monteverdi Vespers, and the Messiah.
Kenneth, now, just finally, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned the Teatro Manuel a little earlier. Of course, you're yourself are involved in that. You obviously look after the festival. You're a well-known artist. It intrigues me. How do you sort of consider yourself? Are you a man of all the arts? Do you consider yourself an artist first and foremost? Is music your passion? How do you decide where you sort of place the emphasis as you're such a sort of a man of contemporary culture?
The most difficult question of all. I suppose I do all this because I love it so much. You know, music has always been my passion, but, you know, I'm primarily a watercolorist, But music and the Manuel Theatre especially have always been great loves in my life. I reviewed music for many years, and sort of creating a festival like this has always been my dream. I've always needed to make something which was economically viable and which people would take to and have all the components in place. And it seems that, you know, so somehow I've hit the jackpot for once in my life.
That was Kenneth Zamit Tabona, Artistic Director of the Manuel Theatre and the Valletta International Baroque Festival, which gets underway tomorrow. Bit of music for you now. Let's hear this one, Shells of Silver by the Japanese pop stars.
When the cold of the day is over and the warmth of the night moves in, there's a house in the stairs beneath my feet.
That's Shells of Silver by the Japanese pop stars for you here on Midori House. You're listening to Monocle 24. We're fast approaching the end of today's programme. Before we go, though, it's time for our daily review segment where we go through the very best in books, theatre, art, music and cinema with correspondents and contributors all around the world. Today, we're talking art. The Museum of Modern Art, or MoMA, is a New York icon. Yesterday, it announced a grand redesign of its building, including a giant retractable glass wall. We sent our own Tristan McAllister to MoMA today to see if there's any buzz, and he joins us now from our New York bureau. Tristan, good afternoon to you. Thanks for joining us on the programme. Tell me, what led up to this most recent development with MoMA?
Well, there's a museum right next door, or at least a former museum right next door. It's the American Folk Art Museum. It's now just a building, but at the time, at least 10 years ago, or a little over 10 years ago, when it was revealed to the world, it had this amazing copper facade, and it was this revolutionary piece of architecture that was also a piece of art, and it really seemed to sort of jive with the Museum of Modern Art, which of course is next door. Now that is just seems at least a bit of a tumor, at least in some people's eyes, because there's nothing in the building at this point. The Folk Museum has moved uptown, actually. And as you said, the Museum of Modern Art is looking to renovate, or at least redo its facade, and give itself a little bit more square footage.
So where does that leave this, the American folk art, this erstwhile favorite? Is it doomed?
Well, at this point, that is what they're saying. And the official line from the museum, of course, out early today was that they tried as hard as they possibly could to see if that existing copper facade, which I have to say is fairly interesting and very different, you won't really see it anywhere else, that copper facade in that building cannot be incorporated into the new design. So it looks as though at this point, a building that is just over a decade old and it really truly a piece of art and something different will be torn down to make way for these upgrades.
Now, Tristan, I know a few architectural types. They're pretty clever. I always imagine they could probably incorporate anything into anything if they were set the challenge. I think you were there a little earlier today. What do people think? Do they feel like they've not sort of trying their best to save this sort of partially beloved institution?
I think that's the question that everyone's asking, Tom. But what is coming from the architects who are working on the revise of the MoMA building, and also from the Museum of Modern Art itself. They're just saying that particular structure built by two local architects just cannot be reincorporated. It's built in funny pieces. To sort of redo it would be colossally expensive and not very effective in terms of what their end goal is. What should also be said here too is that this folk museum sits between the Museum of Modern Art and a completely vacant lot. So in New York, that's like mana to have an open lot next door. And so I would imagine that the real priority here is to maximize square footage. And they really said that their mission could not be accomplished if they were to incorporate this brand new building. What I saw today up there was it seemed a bit of indifference. Of course, the press here are talking a lot about the fact that some architects architects are upset, some historians are upset, some urbanists are upset. You know, the media are sort of having a bit of a frenzy over this, but frankly, there was no one standing there in front of that copper facade today crying. So, I don't know if that's a sign, but the point being that I think, you know, the MoMA is very, very popular. It was absolutely crowded today. It's Thursday in what many would consider the shoulder season. It's cold in New York after the holidays, and it was just jam-packed full of tourists. So clearly, they have to do something to accommodate those people coming to the museum.
Absolutely. Well, maybe you'll have to get there with your placards and your sandwich boards yourself, Tristan, if you're going to be the man to save it. Just very briefly, the museum obviously is committed to, you know, greater footfall, more space. It all makes sense for them. They're happy with this. They're happy. They've got enough money to pay for it. And frankly, they're not that fussed about this unique building, however unique it is.
No, I mean, I think at the end of the day, most people see the Museum of Modern Art as a staple of New York. I mean, it's a huge tourist attraction. As I said, the Folk Museum has moved uptown, so this no longer would be the place for that. It's not as though they're ousting a museum. They're just sort of moving or removing a building to make sure that you can bring this particular, the MoMA Museum, to the street level. That's what they've said all along here, is they're opening the museum to the street. There will be more space that you don't have to get into with a ticket, visible from the street, which in their minds they say will give art to the people. And that was the point of the MoMA from the very beginning.
Absolutely. That's Tristan McAllister in our New York Bureau. I hope you're keeping warm over there, Tristan.
Yeah, awfully cold, but we're trying. It's warming up, so I think we're on the mend.
Good stuff. Well, keep your hat and gloves on. We do worry about you. That's Tristan McAllister in our, let's hope, fairly warm New York Bureau. That's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My special thanks to our guests, Gavin McFadden and Stuart Purvis. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Alexa Firmanich and James Bullock, and our studio manager was Alex Funnell. Next up, after the headlines, is The Urbanist, presented by David Michon. It's the first of a two-part series on the influence of Mayor Bloomberg in New York.
When Mayor Bloomberg took office, it was right after 9/11. People, frankly, thought New York was finished. So I think that's really one of the great accomplishments of Mayor Mike Bloomberg, was that he re-established confidence in the city.
Later on at 2200 hours here in London is The Monocle Daily with Ted Kravitz and Andrew Muller in the chairs today. This show, though, will be back with me at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time. Do tune in. But for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening.
Tells the story of a passion for motor racing, a legend forged over time by the pioneers of speed and great drivers. The Daytona Cosmograph, the watch made to break barriers, the watch dedicated to endurance, the watch that was born to race. Rolex.